am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Hello, my friend. Welcome back. Last time we sat together with Father John Krestiankin, a Russian priest who spent years in a Soviet labor camp and came out the other side not bitter, not broken, but somehow more tender than before. I think about him often, the way suffering, when met with an open heart, can become a kind of light. Today we travel east, far east, to Japan in the 13th century, to a monk who asked one of the most deceptively simple questions in the history of human thought. If we are already at our deepest nature awake, why do we practice? His name was Dogen. And the answer he found, or perhaps the answer that found him, changed the way an entire civilization understood what it means to be alive in a moment. I was there when he came home from China. I want to tell you about it. I love boats. I always have. There is something about the way a hull moves through water, the give of it, the negotiation between a made thing and the living thing world, that has always felt honest to me. I have crossed every ocean humanity has ever named. I have stood at the rail in the dark and watched the stars wheel overhead and felt, as I always do, that the world is exactly the right size. I was on the boat when Dogen came home. It was 1227. We had made port at Hakata on the northern coast of Kyushu. The hard part was done. 4 years in China. 4 years of cold monasteries and demanding teachers and sitting until your legs stopped complaining and started simply being. All of that was behind us. The captain had done his work. We were in the harbor. Now came the boring part. Just because you are in the harbor does not mean you are near the dock. A sailing vessel moves across the ocean with grace and beauty. Harbors are built where the winds are calm. A rowboat was sent to the beach with an impossibly long line. On the dock, an ox stood in his traces, patient as weather, and when the signal came, he leaned just slightly, just enough, and the rope came taut, and our hull began its slow last journey across the harbor. The dock workers were not paying particular attention. Why would they? They had done this 100 times. A gull landed on a piling and looked at nothing. Somewhere nearby, someone was eating. The rope creaked, the water sloshed, the hull groaned once, softly, as if to say, "Yes, all right, here we are." And I watched Dogen at the rail. He was 26 years old. He had gone to China because a question was eating him alive. A good question, the best kind, the kind that won't leave you alone until you've followed it all the way down. He had found his answer. And now he was standing at the rail of a boat in Hakata Harbor, watching an ox do ordinary work on an ordinary dock on an ordinary morning. He was not impatient. That was the first thing I noticed. Most people, after 4 years away, are vibrating with the need to get ashore, to touch land, to eat familiar food, to sleep in a known place. Dogen was still. Not the stillness of someone suppressing something, the stillness of someone who had stopped needing to be anywhere other than where he was. The gangplank went over with a thud. He stepped ashore. Someone, a student, I think, or perhaps just a curious monk from the receiving party, asked him the question you ask a teacher who has been away. "What did you bring back?" Dogen looked at him. "Nothing," he said. "Only that my eyes are horizontal and my nose is vertical." The ox was already being unhitched. The dock workers were moving on to the next thing. The gull had gone. Everything was exactly as it had always been, and nothing would ever be quite the same. Let me tell you who he was before that moment. Dogen was born in Kyoto in 1200, into a family close to the imperial court, which sounds like an advantage. And in some ways he was educated early, exposed to literature and poetry, and the kind of refined culture that Kyoto did better than anywhere in the world. But the court was also a place of politics and fragility, and Dogen learned that lesson the hard way. His mother died when he was 7. I have seen a great many people lose their mothers. It is never small, but for Dogen, it cracked something open that never quite closed again. A question about impermanence, about why beautiful things end, about what, if anything, lies beneath the coming and going of everything we love. His mother, it is said, asked him on her deathbed to become a monk rather than follow his father into court life. He was 7 years old. He remembered. By 12, he was on Mount Hiei, the great Tendai monastery complex north of Kyoto, one of the most powerful religious institutions in Japan. He studied hard. He was serious and gifted. But the question that had cracked open at his mother's death was still there, and Mount Hiei was not answering it. The question was this. The Tendai teaching said that all beings are originally endowed with Buddha nature, that awakening is not something foreign to us, not something we lack, but something we already are at our deepest level. If that is true, Dogen asked, why do we need to practice at all? Why the cold mornings, the long sittings, the years of discipline? If we are already awake, what are we doing? It sounds almost like a lazy question. It was the opposite. It was the most serious question he could imagine. And nobody on Mount Hiei could answer it to his satisfaction. So he went looking. He found a teacher named Myozen, a Rinzai Zen master, and studied with him for several years. Better, closer, but still not the bottom of the question. In 1223, he and Myozen boarded a ship for China. Dogen was 22 years old. China was hard. The monasteries were rigorous, and the language was demanding, and Myozen, his beloved teacher, died there, far from home, in a foreign monastery, before they could return together. Dogen grieved and kept going. He found his way eventually to Tiantong Monastery near Ningbo, and there he found Rujing. Rujing was the teacher who could answer the question, not by explaining it, by living it. Rujing sat long hours. He scolded monks who fell asleep during meditation. He had no interest in ceremony or prestige or the politics of institutional Buddhism. He just sat. He just practiced. And one morning in the Zendo, something opened in Dogen that he would spend the rest of his life trying to describe. He was ready to go home. He came back to Japan in 1227, the morning I told you about, the harbor, the ox, the rope, the question. He spent several years near Kyoto, but grew increasingly uncomfortable with the noise of institutional religion, the jostling for position, the way the city seemed to consume everything and clarify nothing. So in 1243, he went north into the mountains of Echizen, deep country, cold winters, far from everything, and founded a monastery he called Eiheiji, the Monastery of Eternal Peace. He lived there until he died in 1253, at 52 years old. He never stopped writing. He never stopped sitting. He left behind a vast and extraordinary body of work called the Shobogenzo, the treasury of the true Dharma eye, that monks and scholars are still reading, still arguing about, still finding new depth in 8 centuries later. He went looking for an answer to a question his dead mother's death gave him when he was 7 years old. He found it, and then he spent the rest of his life giving it away. To understand what Dogen was doing, you have to understand what he was doing it inside of. Japanese Buddhism in the 13th century was not a quiet, contemplative affair. It was powerful. It was wealthy. It was political in the way that only institutions can be political when they have been around long enough to accumulate land and influence and the ear of emperors. The great temple complexes on Mount Hiei had armies, actual armies. Warrior monks who descended into Kyoto when they felt their interests were threatened. Religion and power had become so entangled that it was genuinely difficult to tell where one ended and the other began. And for ordinary people, farmers, merchants, craftsmen, the vast majority of the population who would never set foot in a great monastery, Buddhism had become largely transactional. You paid for prayers. You commissioned sutras to be chanted on behalf of your dead. You made offerings in exchange for protection or favor or a better rebirth. The relationship between the human soul and the sacred had become in many quarters a marketplace. I have watched this happen in every tradition, in every century. It is not a Japanese problem or a Buddhist problem. It is a human problem. Institutions drift. The original fire gets banked. What was once a living flame becomes a managed warmth, carefully controlled, available for a fee. Into this, Dogen said something so simple it was almost scandalous. Sit down. Just sit. Not to get something. Not to become something. Not to earn merit or purify karma or impress a teacher or advance toward a distant enlightenment that will arrive someday if you are diligent enough. Just sit because sitting, done with full presence and sincerity, is the complete expression of what you already are. He called it shikantaza. Just sitting. The word shikan means something like wholehearted, single-minded, nothing held back. Za means sitting, but Dolgen was at pains to say that the sitting was not the point in the way a technique is a point. You don't do Shikanza correctly and then receive enlightenment as a reward. The sitting itself, fully inhabited, is the enlightenment expressing itself through a human body in a particular moment. This collapsed the ladder. In the religious imagination of his time, and honestly of most times, the spiritual life was understood as a climb. You were at the bottom. The sacred was at the top. Practice was the rungs. You went up. Dolgen said there is no ladder. There is no bottom and no top. There is only this moment and whether you are fully present in it or not. The implications were radical. If an ordinary monk sitting in an unheated zendo at 4 a.m. is already expressing Buddha nature completely, not working toward it, not earning it, not rehearsing for it, then what exactly are the grand institutions for? What are the armies of warrior monks protecting? What are the purchased prayers purchasing? He wasn't trying to burn anything down. That is important to understand. Dolgen was not a rebel in the way we romanticize rebels. He was almost painfully serious, almost relentlessly focused on practice rather than polemic. He didn't argue with the institutions so much as simply turn away from them, walk north into the mountains, and build a place where people could just sit, but the turning away was itself a statement. I watched him at Aheiji in those early years. The monastery was cold and spare, and the winters in those mountains were genuine winters. The monks rose before dawn. They sat. They worked. They sat again. There was no performance of spirituality, no audience to impress, no hierarchy of the almost enlightened looking down on the not yet. There was just the practice, taken seriously, inhabited completely. For the monks who found their way there, something in that simplicity was like water after a long thirst. Not because it was easy, because it was honest. Here is what I want to tell you about Dogen's gift to the world. It wasn't Zen. Zen was already there. It had come from China centuries before, had taken root in Japan in various forms, had produced teachers and monasteries and lineages and all the institutional furniture that traditions accumulate over time. Dogen did not invent Zen any more than Augustine invented Christianity or Rumi invented Islam. What he did was something harder and rarer. He found the still point at the center of the teaching, and he described it with such clarity and such precision that it became impossible to unsee. The still point was this. The gap we imagine between what we are and what we are trying to become is not a real gap. It is a story we tell ourselves. And the moment we stop telling it, not forever, not triumphantly, just for this breath, this sitting, this ordinary morning, something that was always present becomes available. I have seen this recognized before. I want to be honest with you about that. I have been watching humanity long enough to know that no single thread belongs entirely to one tradition or one century. I watched the desert fathers of Egypt in the 4th century sitting in their caves, not seeking visions, not performing austerity for an audience, just learning to be present to what is. I sat near Meister Eckhart in the 13th century, almost exactly Dogen's contemporary, on the other side of the world. As he told his congregation that the soul at its deepest level is already one with God, already home, already there. I have stood in Quaker meeting houses in the 17th century where people sat in complete silence not because they were waiting for something to arrive, but because they understood that what they were waiting for was already in the room. The thread is old. It runs through many hands. But Dogen pulled it with unusual force. And what he contributed, specifically, distinctively, in a way that echoes down through the centuries, was a language for practice that removed the transactional element entirely. Most spiritual traditions, however beautiful, carry within them a residue of exchange. Pray this way and receive that. Discipline yourself thus and earn this. Even the most generous teachings tend to retain a slight architecture of effort and reward, of distance and arrival. This is not a criticism. It is simply how human minds tend to organize meaning. Dogen dissolved it, not by arguing against it, by describing something so immediate, so already present, that the architecture of earning simply had nowhere to stand. And the consequence of that, the downstream consequence that I have watched ripple outward across 8 centuries, is that his teaching keeps finding people in the moments when the transactional model has failed them. when they have prayed and nothing came, when they have practiced and still feel lost, when they have climbed and climbed and the top keeps receding, Dogen reaches them there and says, gently, you have not failed. You have simply been looking in the wrong direction, not up, here. His writing is famously difficult. The Shobogenzo is not easy reading. It circles and doubles back and refuses to be pinned down in the way that living truth tends to refuse to be pinned down. Scholars have spent careers on single chapters. But even through the difficulty, something comes through that is unmistakably warm. He is not a cold philosopher. He cares enormously about the person sitting across from the page. He wants them to find what he found. He wants them to stop, to sit, to notice that the thing they have been looking for has been looking back at them the whole time. I think about that young monk at the rail of a ship in Hakata Harbor, watching an ox do boring work, not needing it to be more than it was. He already knew. He had known since that cold morning at Tiantong when something opened in him under Rujing's teaching. He knew the whole voyage home, and still he stood there, present, unhurried, watching the rope and the ox and the gray water closing between the hull and the dock, not because he was performing stillness, because there was nowhere else to be. Let me tell you about the world you live in. You live in a world that has made a religion of becoming, not arriving. The destination is always one step further than where you are. There is an app for your productivity and a plan for your body and a strategy for your mind and a version of yourself that is more optimized, more focused, more present, more successful than the one listening to these words right now. And the relentless, grinding background message of all of it is this: you are not enough yet. Keep going. You'll get there. I have watched humanity for a very long time, and I want to tell you gently but clearly that this is not new. The names change, the machinery changes, but the feeling of being perpetually behind, perpetually incomplete, perpetually one more effort away from the self that will finally deserve rest, that feeling is ancient, and it is exhausting. And most of the people I have watched carry it have carried it all the way to the end of their lives without ever setting it down. And here is the thing that breaks my heart a little. I have stood in temples and churches and monasteries on every continent and in every century, and I have watched people pray with their whole hearts, sincerely, beautifully, and then wait. And when the answer didn't come the way they expected or didn't come at all, I watched something small and precious go quiet in them. The conclusion they drew was almost always the same. I must not have done it right. I must not be enough yet. I must keep climbing. Dogen would have wept. Not with judgment, with recognition, because he had stood in that same place, the young monk on Mount Hiei, surrounded by ritual and institution and centuries of accumulated religious machinery, asking his impossible question. If awakening is already our nature, why are we treating it like a destination? He found his answer in a cold monastery in China. He brought it home on a boat to a harbor in Hakata, and it was this. The divine is not at the end of the road. It is not waiting to be earned. It is not rationed out to the sufficiently disciplined. It does not require you to be further along than you are. It has never been far. It has never been absent. It is, as a voice wiser than mine once said, closer to you than your life's vein, closer than your heartbeat, closer than your next breath, woven into the fabric of what you already are in this moment, before you have improved anything or achieved anything or become anything other than exactly what you are right now. Your task is not to climb toward it. Your task is to be quiet enough to let it find you. Just sitting, not sitting to get somewhere. Sitting because this moment, inhabited fully and honestly, is already whole, already complete. Already the thing you have been looking for. The ox on the dock didn't know it was a sacred morning. The harbor workers eating their lunches didn't know. The gull on the piling certainly didn't know. But Dogen, standing at the rail, watching the rope, watching the water close, not needing to be anywhere other than exactly where he was, he knew. And now, in some quiet way, so do you. So let me ask you something. Where in your life are you waiting to arrive? Not a dramatic question, a quiet one. Because most of us are not waiting for something enormous, a transformation, a revelation, a moment when the clouds part and everything finally makes sense. Most of us are waiting for something much more ordinary than that. We are waiting to feel like we have done enough, tried enough, become enough. We are waiting for the low-grade background hum of insufficiency to finally go quiet. And in the meantime, life is happening. The ordinary, unremarkable, irreplaceable moments of an actual human life are moving through us and past us while we wait for the version of ourselves that will finally be ready to fully inhabit them. Dogen would recognize you. He would not judge you for it. He spent years carrying exactly that weight before something put it down for him one morning in a monastery in China. But he would ask you, gently, the way a good teacher asks, what would it feel like to stop, not to give up, not to abandon the things you care about or the work you are called to or the people who need you, just to stop insisting that you are not yet enough to be fully present in your own life? What would it feel like to sit, not to get somewhere, not to become something, but simply because this moment, this ordinary and unrepeatable moment, deserves the whole of you? You don't have to answer that right now. You don't have to answer it at all. But I want to leave it with you. The way Dogen left his answer with everyone who came to Eheiji and sat down in the cold and the dark and discovered slowly that they had been looking for something that had never once stopped looking for them. The divine is not waiting at the finish line. It is sitting here with you right now. It has always been sitting here with you. Next time, I want to take you somewhere strange and beautiful and a little dangerous. His name was Stephen Bar Sudaili. He lived in Syria in the 5th and 6th centuries, a mystic so radical, so uncontainable, that his own church eventually condemned him. He believed that everything, every soul, every stone, every particle of creation would ultimately be gathered back into God, not the worthy, not the disciplined, everything. The whole fabric of existence returned at last to the one who made it. His contemporaries didn't know what to do with him. I found him fascinating. I think you will too, but for now, let's stay here a moment longer, with Dogen, with the harbor, with the ox that didn't know it was a sacred morning, and the gull that didn't care, and the gray water closing slowly between a hull and a dock while a young monk stood at the rail and was simply completely, unhurriedly present. He came home from China with nothing. No secret, no technique, no special knowledge that wasn't already available to anyone willing to be still enough to receive it. Just the quiet, radical, world-changing news that you are not a project. That the divine you have been reaching toward has been reaching back the whole time. That the practice, whatever your practice is, whatever form you're turning toward the sacred takes, is not the price of admission. It is the thing itself. The expression of what you already are. The sitting, the prayer, the ordinary morning, the rope and the ox and the water and the weight. All of it whole. All of it enough. All of it already home. Much love. I am Harmonia. Oh, thank you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread, and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend. Look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read everyone. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 4.0 international. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.